Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
What's going on? And I mean that because I've been on vacation and I have no idea what's going on.
What's going on? It's very exciting. You've missed some truly huge announcements. No, there's been nothing, Jason. It's been very quiet.
Yeah, it's August is what you're saying now.
August is dead. This is dead season for us. Whew. Tumbleweeds coming through.
Yeah.
About the most exciting thing, I wrote up this morning as we record this, Apple's new Apple TV remote app. As promised, they delivered a redone Apple. So this isn't just an update. They updated the old one, right?
To work. Add
exactly. It was a huge improvement, 100% improvement to work with the new Apple TV. But they promised that they were going to have a new one that duplicated all the features of the Siri remote, which this one does. It's a little peculiar in a couple ways. So they've now split out. The old one has been renamed iTunes Remote, and it's still works with Apple TVs, including fourth generation Apple TVs. But the new one, which is called Apple TV Remote, does not control iTunes on your Mac at all. It just does Apple TVs.
All right. Fair enough.
There's some stuff is contextual. So for example, as you're like navigating around, it's not until you start playback that you get those 10-second skip forward and backward buttons. They don't show up until you start playing something.
Huh.
There is the ability to force touch, 3D touch, whatever you want to call it, the edges of the sort of touch surface part that like to mimic that feature. But it's kind of janky on the phone. I feel like it just feels weird. It was hard for me to get the pressure right to like use that as an actual feature, like using the actual software buttons far easier. I wrote in the piece and was corrected that there was no volume control as there is. It turns out there is if you have that enabled, the HDMI CEC thing that lets you sort of control your TV or stereo that's plugged in with HDMI, yeah. You can use the volume buttons on the phone to control the volume, which seems weird.
Oh, that's weird.
I get it, but it's a little odd. And the biggest thing I think that people will want from this is that you can do, there's a Siri button on your phone. So you hold that down and say something and it passes that query to the TV.
Mm-hmm.
But what's kind of interesting is as you hold that down, you'll see it triggers on the TV, right? You get that same feedback that you get when you hold down the button on the Siri remote. But it's just passing it through. I assume it's just like streaming like the audio file essentially of your voice, right? It's not like you use Siri on your iPhone to control your Apple TV. It's just being like a conduit.
Right.
Which is a little disappointing because in order for that to be useful, I feel like you need to find your phone, open your phone, find that app, open that app. Get to the Siri button. And if you've lost your Siri remote or you don't want to dig your Siri remote and your phone is handy, okay, but it's way slower than using the remote. And it seems like if you could use the Ahoy telephone to just like call from across the room and say, oh, find this movie or pause or skip ahead 10 seconds, like that would actually be super useful. But that is not an option. So it's a little disappointing. And there's no, as far as I can tell, though you do get the feature that everybody wants from the remote app, period, which is when you get to a text field, it pops up a little keyboard on your phone. You can type stuff in, but there's no way to use the dictation feature. Like it doesn't pass that through. There's not even a button. So you still have to, if you want your dictation, you still have to find your remote. So kind of a bummer there. So it's weird. I mean, I guess it's nice that they did this and it feels sort of like for a sense of completeness, but I don't think it brings much to the table that wasn't already there. So
I guess you can type, right? I
mean, yeah, typing, but you could do that with the remote app. I mean, the old remote app, or a Bluetooth keyboard now that they added support for that. I do think the one thing I didn't test, which I guess I should have mentioned, was I believe because of the accelerometer and gyroscope, you can essentially use the iPhone as a game controller. But I don't really play games on my Apple TV, so that's kind of a non-starter for me. But for some who want more, I mean, I guess that means if you have multiple people, because it seems to use like a pin-based authentication rather than the home sharing that the old remote uses. Hmm. So I guess if you had a bunch of people come over with their iPhones and you all want to play a game on your Apple TV, presumably it would be easier to set that up, I guess. But I'm not sure how many people are clamoring for that. Maybe more developers will use it now.
Interesting. Well, it's progress, right? I mean, it's been close not quite to a year, a year
9 months
coming up to it. Yeah. So it's something. It's progress.
Mm.
There are new betas. I downloaded them.
Yes, I did
too. I haven't looked at them.
I'm I commented on Twitter that I'm really glad that they actually did away with the thing they added in the last beta where it did the little haptic thing when you locked your phone.
Yeah, that was weird.
That was super weird. And I mentioned this to several people who had the same feeling I did, which is where it felt like you were getting a notification. Because I've had that happen to me where I'm like looking at my phone and I go to lock the phone and it buzzes just as I lock it. And if especially if I was in messages or something, then I have to like open the phone and try to figure out like, oh, man, what did I just get a notification for? And so every time I was locking my phone with this, I felt like I must. Oh, I just missed a notification, which is weird. But moreover, it's such a basic functionality to change, you know, almost 10 years in. Right. Like, was that what does that accomplish? I don't really. I guess you know when it's locked.
I like the no secret cows, Dan. I like the no sacred cows approach of like, hey, let's revisit it. Maybe there's a better way to do this. Maybe more haptics in the OS is something we want to do. I get that. And in fact, I actually I'm always a little sad when they try something in a beta and then people complain and then they take it out because I do wonder sometimes about the you know, have some faith in your. In your convictions, right? In your mm-hmm. ideals of sure. like, yeah, just do this, like show it and say, this is what we think it's going to be. And don't crumble like in the next beta.
It was a fast turnaround on that one.
Yeah. It feels like somebody put it in there as an experiment and then some people filed radars or complained on Twitter or whatever. And then somebody else who didn't like that was like, used that as the shred of evidence needed to kill this idea. I'm not saying this was a good idea, but I always have that idea. Like let's make a change and then it's immediately withdrawn. It's like, well, did you not believe in it to begin with, or did you not give it a chance to sink in? It's well, like either one.
It gets harder and harder the more mature the operating system gets, right? Because you know you're fighting against all that inertia of this huge edifice that you've built over time. It's been very successful the way it is. Why should we change it, right? Like that's sooner or later, you know, when you're. I think this is the thing that Apple. I'm not going to say struggled with because I think that's too strong, but I think this is the big challenge that Apple has overcome largely in the last decade or two, which was rather than being defined as by its sort of underdog status. Now it is the establishment in some ways. It is the extremely popular, extremely successful. And so at a certain point, you're fighting against your own complacency and inertia. And for the most part, I think they do pretty well about not resting too much on their laurels, but it is hard, especially as they get bigger and bigger and more successful. It's hard to turn a battleship, right? Like, it takes time, and you don't end up with necessarily the sort of quick changes that you could have tried when you were, like, iterating more rapidly or whatever. But they do change. I mean, iOS 10 does change, like, the unlocking method, right? Like,
right.
That's a pretty big change. So I can understand why they are maybe playing around with all these different, you know, aspects. But that one in particular just stood out to me because I thought it was very, very odd. Sort of came out of nowhere, went back to nowhere.
Went back into nowhere. Yeah. Strange. What else is happening?
Got yourself a squirt gun emoji.
Oh, that's what I heard. I wanted to look at that. The emoji stuff. Jeremy Berg at Emojipedia sent me an email about that. I should check that out because I try to stay on top of the emoji world, you know.
The emoji beat is an important one.
In fact, what I read was that Apple's latest beta turns the gun into a squirt gun, the emoji, but apparently like a Microsoft beta that they just put out turns a non-threatening gun into a real gun. They went the other way.
They had like a ray gun or squirt gun or something. Yeah. That's weird.
Maybe
I don't know
they'll put that one back the other way. I don't know. I don't know. Emoji, it's a weird thing where it's the intersection. Also, there's some different... Apple put in a bunch of emoji that are female versions of previously default male emoji of like athletes and construction workers and stuff like that. And it's one of the interesting things people don't know about how emoji work. And I have this on my list. I have this on my story list. Is you can join the concept of emoji. These characters aren't... they're like every character that we have is actually a number essentially, like every character maps to a number, and the number is what the computer stores. And then you see the number and it translates it into a character. And the same is true for emoji. And emoji is also modifiable. You can have an emoji that comes out of multiple things, multiple places. So like there's an emoji of like a man and a woman kissing with a heart. And there's also a woman and a woman kissing with a heart, and a man kissing with a heart. And those are actually not a single character. They use these things called, I think they're called zero width joins, that what you do is the in terms of the characters, it's saying man plus heart plus woman makes man kissing woman with a heart. And you know, there's obviously an infinite number of combinations of those, and every single one of them needs a custom piece of art. So it's not something that's necessarily going to be there, but what it means is that the operating system vendors can support those images by combining different existing emoji forms without having it like get approved as a new emoji from the emoji subcommittee.
And it's funny because I just noticed this not long before we started recording here. I was texting to Lex Rieben and John Moltz, and I sent them. So there's now, you know, the dancers with the bunny ears.
Right.
There's a male version now in iOS 10. So I sent that to our chat, and it popped up on my Mac running El Capitan. And it showed basically the female dancers and then the male symbol next to it. And so I just tested this because I was curious. And I sent the female detective, and it, shows me the male detective and the female symbol next to it. So that's very clever. Interesting.
Yeah. And so, I went back and forth with Jeremy at Emojipedia about this when the Ghostbusters movie happened, because you can do a ghost and the circle with a line through it as with a zero width join. You can stick those two together, and what happens on all browsers, you know, right now is either nothing or they are just next to each other, or it's a kind of crudely like one the circle goes over the ghost, but not in like an attractive way. But that's an example where like if somebody wanted to make the Ghostbusters logo and have it map to that, that would totally be valid, and it would be it's in emoji now. It's just that until a platform owner builds it, then it doesn't, you know, it's not going to happen. But so this is what happened with Apple's additions of things like if a woman who's a construction worker there's a construction worker emoji and a female indicator, and they're joined together, and the platform decides what to do. And if the platform doesn't support it, it may do something like what you saw, which is the old emoji and then a modifier. But on the new versions of the platform, it just shows the new art that was created.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we and the next generation will truly be separated by a common language.
Yep. It will be zero width separation, apparently.
That's not even that much separation. That's pretty close, really.
I wrote a really, really short thing today about just noting the death of Kagi.
Mm.
Gosh, for those,
takes me back.
For those of us who have been around a long time, so back in the day, there were three kinds of software. There's a software that came in a box that you paid for. There's a software that was downloadable on the internet that was freeware, you know, basically, and you just used it. And then there was this slice in between that is essentially everything we now think of as software, but it was little at the time, which is you pay for it, but it's just downloadable.
And, shareware.
Yeah, it was shareware, or sometimes it was a demo and then you had to pay and then it would unlock. But that was... Kagi was a real trailblazer as a company in letting developers charge for software. They integrated into the software, which was one of the most clever things about what Kagi ended up doing, is that you'd run the software, and instead of it saying in an about box somewhere, you should pay for this, it would actually like bring up a dialog box and you could click and like go and pay for it, and it would register, and it was sort of like happening in the app, and then it would kick you out and bring you back. And it was the way before the Mac App Store and the iOS App Store, and before big vendors came into the market with their own subscription plans and things like that, and before things like Stripe made it relatively easy for anybody to set up a storefront and take credit card orders, Kagi was the thing that you did if you charge for Mac software. And A lot of people used it, and a lot of people still used it just because they knew it and they had it set up. And you know, inertia is a powerful thing. It still worked fine. But then something happened, which is Sunday night, Kagi.com got a new homepage that was basically a black screen with a graphic on it with a tombstone and about five paragraphs that said, as of, you know, the end of July, Kagi has ceased to function. We've been struggling with financial losses for a decade due to a supplier fraud situation, whatever that means. Hmm. And if we owe you money, expect to be contacted in the next month by a third party that is going to manage the dissolution of our assets. There was no warning. So, like, our friend James Thompson, he drag thing, you know, he's been doing for so long that it's like Kagi is completely tied into DragFang. James, you know, keeps it running, but DragFang's old, got a very old code base. James figured out how to make code changes in to DragFang, but he's got all these old resources that are from I think PowerPlant, which is this, you know, PowerPC basically. Tool, and he was making changes on Monday morning when he found out that Kagi was dead. He was trying to do a new build drag thing that didn't reference Kagi, and he had to use an OS9 in a virtual machine.
Yeah, I saw that.
Which, and now apparently good. He found that there's
he an found a tool. Yeah,
there is an Intel version of something that will build that will do that. But he was rushing to do that, and he still has money. He says not a lot, but he said he still had money coming in from Kagi, and it's unclear what he's going to get, if anything, from this last month. And then he also said that he has heard. So it's a, you know, through the grapevine kind of thing. I don't have confirmation of this, that you know, at least one developer did a major product launch and has like six figures of cash that Kagi owes him that doesn't. Will they ever see that? I don't know. It's bad. It's a bad situation. And it's a sad end for kind of a major. Kagi enabled a lot of independent Mac developers to make a living writing software.
Yeah, I was looking back at I just searched in my email because I was curious, and I found an email from 2006 that is a my original purchase, I believe, of Mars Edit.
Wow,
which I am still using even now. And then I saw one later for Flickr Export, which was Fraser Spears' old app for uploading stuff from iPhoto to Flickr. I remember it farther back than that even. But yeah, it was definitely the, you know, the middleman before Apple and before it became more efficient, like you said, for people to take, because it used to be a huge pain to set up a storefront, right? Like you had to get getting like secure certificates for your store so you could make secure transactions or whatever. Like that was all just, it was all just a mess in the early days.
Yeah, the last thing I bought on Kagi was my my weather station software, that was 2014. I think I've upgraded since then. I think maybe they moved away from it after that. But I did buy my weather station software there in November 2014. And that's the last. As my wife always says, when a restaurant that we went to one time, or some business we went to one time, and we discover it went out of business, she always says, "Well, I guess our one visit in ever didn't keep them in business." Yep. Right? It's like, that's not enough. Like, oh, I bought some software from you 2 years ago. Did that help? Yeah, not no. Probably, not really.
Wow, I just stumbled across an email where they built their own replacement. Do you remember Visual Hub, which was a conversion software? I'd forgotten that they had, I guess, sort of tried to build a sort of pick up the reins for that after it died. With themselves, I guess. I don't know. I have some emails from them exchanging emails with someone who was sending me messages about this. So yeah, interesting history. I think very fondly back to those days, sometimes even before that, of I remember buying the earliest stuff I can remember buying as a kid and sending my money away for shareware were the Ambrosia games. Because I bought many of the Escape Velocity games, and even before that, some of the other games they said, and they'd send you a postcard in the mail that had your license key on it. And somewhere I still have a few, I think, of my original license keys for those games. And that was sending in my hard-earned money as a teenager. Yeah. And I briefly had a, I'm not even going to call it a career because that's totally misleading, but I did like used to post shareware app or two on the BBSs that I used to frequent. And I had a couple times where I actually got sent money for them and I was charging an insane, like I was charging like $15 for software that people were sending me, which was ridiculous given the terrible, terrible software that I was writing. And now you think about people buying software for $15 and it's like, it's more, the software that goes for a dollar is more functional than the stuff I was charging $15 for 20 odd years ago. But it was best because they would send me, I didn't have any way of taking credit cards. They would send cash in envelopes, including change, which you're not supposed to do.
No.
But it was still pretty funny to get an envelope full of like, you know, oh, here's a $10 bill and like a bunch of quarters.
Well, James Thompson again, boy, that guy, he has a great story. So I've known James since the 90s because I reviewed, I think I was on the beta, and I don't know how I got on the beta. It might have been through Stefan Somogyi, who worked at Mac User back then. But I got on the beta, I think, of Drag Thing, and I thought it was great, and I reviewed it. I gave 5 mice. That was back at a time when it was like 5 mice, but it was in this ghetto of like shareware reviews. It didn't count as like real software, which is dumb. I always told them it was dumb. I was proven right, at least, eventually. It took a while. But, and so I've known, I mean, that was 95. I mean, that was a long time ago. Long time ago. He tells the story about when he started doing Drag Thing. It was a, he started building, well, he started PCALC as a university project. And then Drag Thing, I think he did just out of university. And these programs he wrote, he didn't charge for them initially. So he made what he called coolware, which was send me something cool. And he put his address. Now, first off, again,
putting your address in software,
in software, in the about box, just send me stuff is amazing. And people send him stuff. And, he tells this story better than I'm going to be able to do it, but, lots of interesting stuff he was sent. And at one point he gets a call from somebody who's a company. It's like, I don't know, AT&T or somebody who wants to do a site license for a Drag Thing. And it turns out coolware doesn't really scale to a site license. And the guy at AT&T calls him and is a little befuddled and is sort of like, well, look, I want to get this for my whole work group and it's hundreds of people and we love it and we want to use it, but I don't really know what to do in terms of coolware. How about I send you money?
Money's cool.
And I think James's response to that was something like, money, you say. Interesting. Anyway, he made it shareware, not too long after that, and used Kagi also to bring it back to that. But that was the back in the day. You know, there was first it was the idea of like, look, it's just cool. Send me something cool. And there was also that money thing. I had some shareware where it was like send me $5 to $3, but it was like literally put a check in the mail to somebody.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And it was huge deal once you could do it online, because you know all the people were downloading software from the internet in those early days. It's not like they couldn't get somewhere, but like there was no e-commerce infrastructure. There was no encryption in browsers. There was nothing you could do to facilitate financial transactions on the web.
Yeah, I mean, and the reason that those people were sending me cash through the mail was also because as a teenager distributing stuff on BBSs
didn't have
frequented by teenagers.
Yeah, they don't have bank accounts or credit
card
numbers.
Checks they or credit checks. Cards. Yeah, they had $5
they
in quarters.
Yeah. Makes sense. Store checks out.
But yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, to sort of segue, this is one of the interesting things I always think about when people talk about privacy and encryption. You know, especially when they talk about, and this is at least, I think, died down a bit in the last couple months, thankfully, the encryption debates over weakening encryptions to give government or law enforcement ability to access these things. And I think people forget how important it is to these things like commerce. You know, you couldn't really do electronic commerce if you didn't have strong encryption, and weakening that in any way, which the U.S. did historically in the 1990s. They made it really hard to export strong encryption out of the country. I think really held back, you know, the idea of electronic commerce. And now with how much is done electronically. I pay all my bills online. You know, I buy all my stuff on Amazon. I buy a bunch of software on iTunes and music and movies, et cetera, et cetera. If I didn't have strong encryption or didn't trust at least, you know, some degree of security there, that would pretty much hamper all of those things. And I mean, you see how bad it is even when you just have a security breach of some kind. But the idea that all the encryption might be weakened in some way it's really kind of frightening.
Yeah. You're going on vacation.
I am in less than 24 hours here.
It's good. We're ships that are passing in the night.
Yes, so you got to experience that. Now it is my turn.
Yeah, that's fair. That's
the great unknown.
I didn't skip a clockwise though, but you're going to skip a clockwise next week. So.
I am. It's just sadly, it's not a. I could even bring my equipment probably, although yeah. I would love to find a better travel solution.
Yeah.
It's just that I won't have internet, yeah. So no, that's going to be an issue.
It's good. It's I can make it work, and then you know there will come a day when you will need to do an episode of Clockwise without me. So
I've done episodes of Clockwise without you.
I know.
We will continue. I appreciate
it.
Yeah,
it's just the balance goes back and forth. Like the last, you know, it all works out.
I understand, Don Snellioni.
Yes. There will come a time when I ask you for a favor.
Okay. I'll, on the day of your daughter's wedding.
Yeah. That's right. I'll stick an orange in my mouth and go... and then collapse.
This has been our 30-second reenactment of
the
God, every podcast I've been on today has been full of spoilers. What is happening?
Spoilers. Everyone's for The Godfather. If you missed The Godfather in the 70s, The Godfather dies at the end. Now you know. Of old age. How about that? Of old age. Now that's the real spoiler. My cousin always used to tell me that his dream was to die like The Godfather. He wanted to be... an old man putting orange slices in his mouth, running around with his grandkids, have no idea what was going on, and then just drop dead. So, dream is still alive. He may get there. That may be. He needs to get some grandchildren.
I feel like that would be traumatic for the grandchildren, too.
Yeah, but what will he care? He will have died happy. And
that's fair point. Fair point.
And that's how you build a new generation of mobsters.
That is how you build a new job.
I don't know what my cousin is thinking, but that's Don Corleone had it figured it out. That's what I'm saying.
This is how we build a new generation of, you know, Apple Tech news writers.
I guess. Yeah, something like that. Well, you have a good vacation. I'll be here working because I already had my vacation.
Thanks. Hold down the fort.
Yeah, I will. I'll make sure that doesn't blow away or anything.
You should build your fort out of something that's not going to blow away. If there's anything I learned from the Three Little Pigs.
And so next week... might be a monologue by me. Might be nothing. I don't know. When do you get back?
The following Monday, the 15th.
Forget it. All right. Well, then next week, it's a great mystery whether you'll hear anything next week or
not. You can phone me up. Call a friend.
I have thought about that, of like just dialing you in and being like, hey, Dan, it's the Secret Podcast. What you doing? We'll see.
I'll have to see how good the cell phone reception is. But yeah, give it a whirl.
Okay.
Give it a whirl.
Maybe we'll do that. Secret subscriber phone call. Yeah.
it's like the best conference call ever.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks to everybody out there for subscribing to Six Colors. We really appreciate it. You help us do what we do by supporting us. And it's awesome that you do that. And we'll be back maybe next week. Maybe Dan will be here. Maybe he'll be on the phone. Maybe he'll be nowhere except on vacation.
He'll be somewhere.
He'll be somewhere. Yeah. You'll be somewhere. Just not maybe here in this virtual location of the Secret Subscriber Podcast. But until then, bye, everybody.
Bye, Jason.
Bye, Dan.